But because we have not yet finished what we have agreed upon and the work that we are supposed to be doing, I then appealed to the defense chief to give us the opportunity to come and do and take us through the presentation. The minister is here today. She will direct us how she would want to go through the agenda itself. I want to make sure that everybody has got the agenda in front of him. And I do hope some journalists also do have the agenda in front of them so that they can understand what the purpose of the meeting is about. Minister will feel, and the deputy minister want to welcome you in our ranks. We are continuing with the work that you have put in front of us. So, the one thing that I just want to make clear, did every member of the committee receive those that, not even if you are going, did you receive the program of going to the borders from the 27? Many does have copies, has been trying to circulate that program. Any member who doesn't have the program will definitely give you the program today. I have just been whispering with the minister. Journalists, you are invited to go with us to the borders. But you know the reference point is the ministry that will do all the preparations. We are going along as her guest towards the border itself. We want to thank you quite early for that one, minister. I've seen all the preparations are on point. They are going on very well. Can I give over to you to start the session?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and welcome to the Deputy Minister. Again, our apologies for taking long. We had taken the opportunity to invite the state law advisors with us. They comprise a delegation of four people. And with your permission, perhaps what they could do is take us through the bill that I introduced last year. So they then took time to explain to me how far they are with the bill, because we have made a request to the leader of government business that we fast-track this matter. Unfortunately for us, we really have run behind our schedule. We would have wanted by the 1st of April. We could have had a call-up of our reserves. But this is now a matter that is entirely in your hands. The matter has not yet been referred to Parliament. So what we're doing is running a simultaneous process so that by the time it is referred to Parliament, you are completely on top of the situation. So, Chairperson, with your permission, this is how I would like to deal with the matter of the agenda in front of me. Thereafter, we will go back to the matter of a continuation of key defense matters, and then we will deal with the progress on the establishment of the department, not the policy matters, but just the Department of Military Veterans and Department of Military. It's not defense. There are two departments. One is defense and the other one is military veterans. Proclamation, we already have a proclamation establishing the SANDF. So that one, if you could please stand that one down. I'd like us at another time to come back to the matter of the deunionization of the SANDF. At the moment, we're still dealing with a whole lot of vital issues, especially around the budget. This one I'd like us to come back to at a later stage. Operation Corona, yes, we will be dealing with a number of issues to do with Operation Corona, and I'm glad that you're coming along with us. It's a whole three-day trek. So you will be given a breakdown both by my office and the Admiral here. I need to say that, we've got to be very careful in the way that we exercise democracy. I think this is to do with power. The exercise of power is absolutely very important because it can either be used for good or can be used for bad. I had asked the department to come and give you a briefing on Operation Corona as part and parcel of you understanding what we're doing, especially the question had been asked, when are we going to the borders? It was a public matter. We brought the matter of Operation Corona to yourselves, And apart from pointing out that Peter Tief was wrong, which was wrong, and we corrected that, what has since happened, however, is that information has then been made public about what the priority areas are. And we then are faced with a situation where the farmers in Lesotho, on the Lesotho border, are taking us to court because we are not prioritizing. Now, we've got it all times to make sure that we are able to weigh operational matters that can be made public and matters that of a national security that should not be made public. We're interacting with the Farmers Union because I think that the information they got was very wrong. Because the last thing we want is to have a situation where those people who we deem most vulnerable do not believe that we are protecting them. And this was an unfortunate matter that arose from this committee. So even as we deal with this, I would like you to understand that we have obligations behind us, beyond ourselves. Beyond the parties that we represent, we have obligations that have to do with the security of the country, and I'd like, please, that we exercise them very carefully and diligently. So what we will do with Operation Corona is just those areas where we're going to, but not the operational details. Okay? Operation Clean Audit is a matter that I came and briefed you about it, but I want to make myself available again should we want to get back to that matter as we prepare to go to as we go to the budget vote. And the action plan, you know, to deal with the audit qualifications, 3.61 is not priority one. And I'm told David Mania wants to talk about SCOPA. I am so ready to talk about SCOPA. Right. So we will talk about SCOPA, and we will talk about my anger. And I will want to emphasize that I have also taken the necessary steps to lodge a complaint. But that will come at 3.8. Right. Okay.
That would be the last matter.
Yeah. You know, 3.0, I do want us to deal with this. There is a disjuncture in the way that oversight over defense is conducted, and it must be attended to. It really must be attended to. You see, unless we actually have the instrument and the tool that has that has the confidence of the Defence Force, and also where the Defence Force feels that they can share their concerns with, that also lives by particular regulations, and then we will have the kind of exercise of democracy that we want. But to have 300 committees that are demanding the attention of defence is not right. Defence matters does deal with security matters. And the reason why the Joint Standing Committee was established by the Constitution, in fact, the only two constitutional bodies, is to give them the kind of insight that they really need to have. Anything else is established by rules of parliament and completely, you know, it doesn't have the ability to get into the matters of defense that we might need either in the country or in parliament. So I want to urge you, please, to... We will come back to you perhaps when we are dealing... Yeah. We'll put it under the whole rubric of parliament, okay, and the defense white paper. Yeah. And then to 3.7, I had asked for it to stand down, because that is the basis of my budget vote. There would be no point in going to budget vote if we've already had it here. No.
So we have 3.5 and then 2.6.
Yeah. Yeah. So we will. Yeah. If we could then, with your permission, rearrange it in that way. Okay. Fine. So with your permission then, Chairperson, and having welcomed here, as you know, all the people that are here, I'd like to welcome to our meeting the Chief State Law Advisor, Mr. Edward Daniels, and his team, please to take us through the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm accompanied here today by Karen Boyce, deputy in my office, and Herman Smuts and Mongamela Kweta, and they will actually take the committee through the bill. Mongamela Kweta will deal with the reserve force section of it, and Herman Smuts will deal with the commission, if you don't mind, chairperson. And so I'll call on Mongamela Kweta to address us. Thank you.
Can I just make sure that all the members have got the amendment bill in front of them? If all members have got it, we are going to fix that. Can you help them, David? Kekana, you're okay then? Yeah. Tabo? Tabo Tatumlangin is struggling here. Tumana, are you okay? Yeah, you are there. Katutola, are you okay?
Yes.
Okay. We just saw Tatu Tatumlangin. Mendy, can you give Tatumlangin a copy? He has got too many papers. He can't see properly. Give him a copy. Okay. Can we have some order so that you can start the meeting? Yeah. Let the lawyer start.
Thank you, Chair. Mohamed Kreta is my name from the Office of the Chief Legal Advisor, as the Chief introduced us. Chair, I will deal with the part dealing with the reserve force regarding this proposed piece of legislation. Apparently, Chair, as we may be aware, the Defence Force is divided into the reserve force and the permanent force. Apparently, Chair, with regard to the reserve force members, the anomaly is that the members of the reserve force are only utilized or may only be utilized only during the times of war, state of national emergency, state of national defense, or state of emergency, Chair. And the other problem, Chair, that has been encountered by the department is that not all these reserve force members have entered into contract of service. And as a result, this creates problems regarding the planning of the defense force. Because now they are not really sure what numbers they have at their disposal to utilize these reserve force members. Therefore, Chair, this particular piece of legislation is trying to close that gap. And you will notice that in terms of the specific clauses of the bill, the first clause is specifying that all members of the reserve force must enter into a contract of service with the defense force, and this must be done, the proposal is that must be done 18 months after the coming into operation of this piece of legislation. Therefore, all members of the reserve force will have to enter into a contract of service. And there is also a proposal that if the minister will prescribe the period of service of these members of the reserve force in terms of the contract. And if, for instance, there is an operation in which a reserve force member is involved and then the period of the contract expires, then a minister may, with the concurrence of this particular member or members, extend that contract or the period of the contract so that that particular member can continue and serve during that particular operation. The other clause specifically deals, Chair, with that if there's a call-up order by a commanding officer of this reserve force member, then that reserve force member has to comply with that call-up order and report for duty. And the consequences of failure for that is that this member will be committing an offense. And, Chair, the other clauses, they specifically deal with the content and format of the contract that it will be prescribed in terms of supported legislation. And Chair, the last clause specifically deals with this particular failure of a reserve force member to report for duty if he has been called up for service. Therefore, Chair, this gap is being closed by ensuring that all members of the reserve force enter into contracts of service and are utilized during times of peace, not only during times of war, only during times of peace for certain operations, and they have to comply with call-up orders. That is briefly what the proposed legislation is about. Thank you.
That is the shortest amendment we need to do in terms of the reserve force. That's what we need to do and keep the capacity. Do you have questions around this one, honorable member? If I hope you are also part of the reserve force so that you could be called up. You can answer.
Chair, in terms of process, I mean, I obviously have several questions about this amendment, but we are going to deal with this bill as a committee, presumably in time to come, and we can deal with the questions and queries at that time, I presume.
You see, as the Minister have explained, that's why we've got the state law advisor here, is to fast track the process. You know that we have also preparations for FIFA, so Parliament is going to be suspended for some time. So what we are trying to do is to give knowledge to members about what awaits them. Because also before the after it has been submitted in Parliament, we do have to go to hearings with a variety of people and stakeholders affected by this particular matter, and then after that it becomes law. So what the opportunity is today is for you to pose your questions and get more clarity. No, I see Utata is not here. You will come after him.
I just want the clarity from the chairperson. You know, during the government of the previous regime of the National Party government, National Party, there used to be what they called conscription into the army, where David and them, you know, because they were white, would be forced into joining the army. Now, this call up here, is it something similar to that? Similar to conscription, the call-up system?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. I can see that there's a requirement for this amendment. But just a question of clarification. Will the amendment make provision in the event where a reserve force member is called up but may have a legitimate reason to apply for a deferment? I'm thinking, for example, of a farmer who may be harvesting, a small businessman who may be at year end. There may be legitimate reasons for a member of the reserve force to apply for deferment, and does the bill make provision for that? That's the first thing. The second thing is, in respect of employers, as a result of this bill, is there an obligation on the Defence Force to compensate employers for the loss of employees who may be called up for service from time to time in the Defence Force? Thank you.
To try to get more to the real bone, you know we're in a constitutional state and individuals have got rights. How far does it border on their individual right when the call-up are being done? How much constitutional, I mean, like explanations can you give where the rights of the individuals are being protected? Do you say this call-up can, I mean, I'm just trying to understand, are you seeing that if the individual says, I don't want to go, how far does the law stretch to assist or to deter that particular person? And also, how much does it, you see, I see here the powers goes to the minister, and there's a chief of defense. How does that relationship work? Why is it the minister that is supposed to be the one that works on the contracts of that particular individual? What happened to the chief of defense? Because if there's a commander and there's a chief of defense and there's the ministry, why does the power have to go to the minister, why is he not the chief of defense? If you could give us an insight of your thinking. I'll take one member here. Mambu, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Morning to all. If I'm retarding my purpose, say it. But they can answer it today or not today. Because it's deeper than what I'm going to say is deeper than what you guys know. I might be far left behind because I wasn't saying. You know, when we are talking about reserve force, I think somebody raised something closer to what I want to find out. When they are not doing reserve, where are they? What are they doing? And who monitors and supervises what they are doing there in relation to the objectives, the aims, and the need for us to have a South African National Defense Force? The classes that are handled, or the training or the monitoring of the employers, is it a total standalone type of employers versus people who get called to a disciplined team that is always there? I'm missing that. What happens when they are there, wherever they are called out from? Thank you.
It is a point of question. I'll give over to the state lawyer advisor and the team to answer.
Thank you, Chief. My colleague here will deal with the question. But the call-up isn't conscription. It's not conscription. The call-up is in terms of the contract concluded between the minister and the relevant member of the reserve force. And then in terms of the act, the reserve force composes those members of the defense force who immediately before the commencement of the act have been serving voluntarily in a component known as the citizen force or the commandos. So the reserve force caters just for those people who have been serving voluntarily. But this act appears to regulate, or rather wants to regulate, that relationship. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I will try and attempt to answer the question, Chair, as far as I can. As Mr. Daniel stated, Chair, the conscription is not what is in the decision of the bill, Chair. The bill primarily promoted the principle of voluntariness. Because, Chair, well, once a person, for instance, a person is working full-time, 12 months a year, and that person will enter into a contract with the reserve force. And then the contract may state that I am available for 30 days a year. And then once you even specify in the particular contract that when are those days are going to be, whether in 1 month or in the period of being called up for two days a month or 3 days a month. Therefore, Chair, once you enter into that contract, the defense force will call up you for those specific times. Therefore, Chair, you will have an option of, before you enter into the contract, you will have a choice of entering or not entering into the contract. There will be a consensus between the defense force and you. When you are called up in terms of the contract that you entered into with the defense force. And Chair, the issue of compensation for employer, Chair, is not contained in the bill, Chair, because as I said, you'll be entering the contract voluntarily. You will know that at a particular time, I won't be involved with employment. So, Chair, the issue of compensation for employer, Chair, is not contained in the bill. And Chair, the issue of the power being given to the Minister of the Chief of Defence Force, I think, Chair, that would be issue of a policy decision, whether the power should be with the Minister or the Chief. But primarily, in terms of legislation, it is the Minister who is always empowered to make regulations in terms of an Act of Parliament. Thank you, Chair.
We have here disguised in a suit a former chief general of the Joint Operations. who might want to answer some of the questions. But I wanted to say that what we've got to understand is that this amendment of our laws to ensure that we are able to draw in the reserves comes primarily from the reserves themselves, because they feel extremely disadvantaged. Especially those who've been trained by us and were not able to absorb them into the core defense force sit out there with absolutely no possibility of employment while we sit here and need people very desperately. So I think that it is a need we should have responded to a little earlier. These are people who are trained and we should take up the responsibility. Of course, the call-up will be dependent on each person, whether they are able to respond to the call-up then or not. If they're not able to, then they will not register. There will be a general registration of all of those members of the Defense Force that want to be in the call-up.
Okay. Is there any other question? Or some question that is not clear? Dr. Mazia.
Yeah, Chairperson, what is not clear that there is an explanation that says previously when there are call-ups, one would decide not to come or to come because it was a voluntary exercise. But it is not clear as of whether now, when there are call-ups, members are obliged to come. But also, what is also missing is a point of compensation. Is it a voluntary participation without any compensation, or is there going to be compensation now? Because previously, I suppose there was no compensation. What is going to happen now?
Thank you, Chairperson. You'll see provision is made for them to get some compensation. The vendor discipline allowances have to be prescribed, and that's already in the existing act. But they have to comply with the call-up. And bear in mind, these are people who served voluntarily before and want to serve again. And in fact, we make provision in the act at the moment for them to extend that service on a voluntary basis if they so wish. So that element of voluntariness extends beyond the contract call-up period. We still give them the right to volunteer to serve at any other time. Bear in mind, a lot of what is going to regulate the activities of the reserve force will be prescribed in the regulations to be made by the minister.
I still wanted you to comment about the constitutionality of that. Is it voluntarily? Doesn't border on the constitution, and I just wanted you to give us a sense of why do you say the minister must take responsibility of this contract and not the chief of defense. I mean, I understand what your colleague says, it is a matter of policy, but I just wanted to know how did you come to such a decision and put it on paper. It is a matter of policy that we should be engaged into. But I'll tell you, we also have the organogram of the department overall. You see, now it becomes difficult because you see, you also have got the Secretary of Defense who is there also. You've got the Chief of Defense and you've got the Ministry. Now why does that power have to go to the Ministry to deal with contracts of people who want to come into voluntarily into the defense? Why would you give such a power to them? Give us a sense so that at least when we engage into it ourselves, we understand what are the challenges that make you to put it at that level. Why not leave it either with the Secretary of Defense or give it to the Chief of Defense? Give us a sense. If there's no other reason, we'll debate it at our own side.
Chairperson, honorable members, my colleague Mr. Kweta indicated that it's really a policy decision, but constitutionally it's sound. There's nothing unconstitutional about it. In fact, in an earlier case in the Defense Union versus the Minister of Defense, the Constitutional Court noted that, in fact, it's the minister who engages with the Defence Force in the Bargaining Council, for example, not the Chief of the Defence Force, not the Secretary, but the Minister, and the Constitutional Court recognise that. Obviously, Chairperson, Honourable Members, there's a delegation which takes place by the Minister to different persons, but this deals with a category of persons in the Reserve Force, and presumably the Minister herself would want to make certain that there's proper sort of coordination and regulation of that Reserve Force, bearing in mind that they're highly skilled people, highly trained, and the Minister would want to know that there is an element of some sort of regulation, which is then properly coordinated through the Secretary and the Chief of the Defence Force. I'm assuming that that will be worked out in the regulations and in the internal delegations that may apply. But constitutionally, we think it's absolutely sound. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I don't recall that my question in respect of deferment was answered. I mean, it seems to me that there could be a scenario where a soldier who has entered into a voluntary contract with the Defence Force, for example, to serve for 30 days, experiences a bereavement 3 days before his or her call-up. What mechanism is there for that person to apply for a deferment of service?
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry I didn't answer your question. Bear in mind we need to distinguish between two situations. One is a state of war, I suppose, and deployment during peacetime. And so different considerations will apply. In peacetime, we may want to be able to say, sorry, Minister, but I'm not able to go because I need to harvest my farm. But that will be dealt with in the regulations. In fact, what we do say is that the content and the format of the call-up must be prescribed by the Minister in the regulations. And I'm assuming that those regulations will be the subject of discussion between the Minister, members of the Reserve Force, and other interested parties.
Thank you. I'm requesting that under background, the point that the Minister also mentioned, which I'm happy with it, that these are people who are trained by us. It should be outstanding, because this is a transformation. We are coming from a country where all defense reserves were so many. That should be there, instead of we started Reserve Force members currently. Who are they? That should be there, so that we know what we are dealing with. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just in relation to the last question, bear in mind we're dealing with a specific category of people, and that category is already defined in Section 53 of the Principal Act. And it talks about the members of the Defence Force who immediately before the commencement of this Act, that is the Defence Act, were serving voluntarily in a component known as the Citizen Force or the Commandos, and they must be regarded as having been enrolled as members of the Reserve Force in terms of this particular section. So we're talking about a small, narrow group of people, easily identifiable, to whom this amendment will apply.
Okay.
I hear the explanation. I'm not denying it. But when, as a member of the country, comes and reads the background, I need to find that. I don't need to page through. I need to find the background. Who are these people? Thank you.
No,
thank you, Chairperson. We can address the members' concerns by explaining it in the amendment as well. It would be a repetition, but we can do it if it's going to help to simplify it and make it more easily understood. Thank you.
With us, it's not repetition, it's emphasis of the point, so that you could be able to know where it is written, so that it could be, as it would appear, we've got more clarity. You see, State Law Advisor, why I'm raising the question, I'm raising it, you see, there's going to be another amendment that you want to bring in, which the Minister says, it does create a lacoon, it's how she has put it, about the powers with whom are they vested, you see, with the Ministry, with the Commander-in-Chief, or who, you see. Now, if you give the reserves and the contract to the Minister, what does that imply? This is why you are not making me happier. I understand, you say, but you know that the Chief of Defense derives his powers also from the minister. But why do you want us to legislate it in here under the reserve when you are saying that the commander, which is separate from the minister, who is more junior, would have an interaction by law with the person that is in the contract, but the total power to verify and to see that person can come back to the defense force, you won't give that power to the minister. That's all I'm trying to find out. What are we trying to write up here so that we know exactly what we are dealing with? Not that to say that I know that the minister is a political head. That I agree, but she's got a defense force. I mean, the Chief of Defense. She's got the Secretary of Defense. These are people that are also under her. Why do you want to give that power with the ministry? That's what I'm interested in, so that I know you are a good lawyer. You'll be able to give me some guidance around this particular matter.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, bear in mind, it's not unusual in our legislation, in any type of legislation, to give the minister powers to enter into contracts with various categories of people or with individuals. We do that on a daily basis. And so for me, as a constitutional lawyer, there's nothing unusual about this. But bear in mind, the critical thing for this committee to note and to acknowledge is the fact that once they called up, they're not under the control of the minister any longer. They're under the control of the military. And I think that's the important thing. But given the fact that this is a narrow, specialized, highly trained group of people who presumably you want to make certain don't go astray, don't get involved in unlawful activities, don't undermine the state, don't start fraternizing with enemies of the state, presumably it highlights the need for us at the highest possible level to interact with them and to keep them happy and to keep them satisfied by the minister herself, or in the future maybe himself, entering into contracts with the reserve force. I think that's very important, because there is a lot of politics involved around the reserve force, and you want to keep them happy and interact with them at that level, so that you recognize, firstly, that they can play an important role in the defense of the country and in bringing stability to the country and peace to the country, and at the same time managing them at the political level to ensure that for the other 11 months that they're not engaged in military activities, that they're not straying out of line. So again, constitutionally, Chairperson, we're happy with it. There's nothing untoward about it. And you'll notice even the Constitutional Court recognizes that the minister is in fact the person who speaks on behalf of the whole military when it comes to issues relating to the military, particularly issues around conditions of services and all kinds of other things. And so there's nothing unconstitutional about it. Thank you.
You want to say something, or can I give these three members and then you'll come here? Okay, that's right.
You say the second line of the memorandum. Say the members of the reserve force may only be obligated to serve during the time of war, state of national defense, or state of emergency. That's what you are saying. And two, further down, you say, from line, second line, from this paragraph, it says that members of the reserve force may not be obligated to serve during peacetime or in the circumstances short of time of war, state of national defense, or state of emergency. Are you not negating the first part of where you are saying that they may be obligated to serve during the state of emergency, among other things? And here you are saying they may not be obligated to serve. Is that not are you not negating the first prophet? Or do I understand this correctly? This is the point I'm trying to make.
Yes, I do.
I apologize, Chair. This is less a question about the legislation, but than a question about the role of the reserves. And I raise it as a result of the reference on page 2 of the memorandum, 4B. I think it's probably the draft memorandum, not the final memorandum, where there's the following sentence appears in brackets. Reserves were called up to man bases when the regulars marched on the Union buildings. My question is, what role did the reserves play when the regulars marched on the Union buildings? That's not a question I expect the state law advisor to be able to answer.
Just for comparison, because these are all security apparatus, the one that we get at our constituency offices are the police reserves. They come and say, we've been trained and we feel we are well trained, we understand we are not professional police, but we actually not absorbed into the system. I'm just saying, now that this is there, are you sure you won't experience the same thing where the reserves are complaining? Remember, this is the day of unemployment. That they are there, they are trained, and some of them are not absorbed. Because we regularly get this, as I'm drawing that parallel, in the police.
We have got that question.
Remember, so that we can move to the next point. That Matanzu, let me start with the Deputy Minister.
Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. I was actually not going to speak because I was not aware that the memorandum on the objectives of the bill that the members are now referring to is also distributed. But now that it is also with members, maybe we should clarify something which is contained in the memorandum, which may not accurately reflect what the intention of the bill is. However, I was not worried because in the draft amendments to the bill themselves, that problem is not there. And I'm just going to point out to it now. You see, on the first page of that memorandum of objectives, point two, at the end there, it says, this is intended to address this towards the end of the second paragraph, two, it says, to address this lacuna, it is proposed in the bill that the reserve force members should be obligated to serve during peacetime under the following circumstances, and it enumerates them there. Where life, health, or property are in imminent danger, to ensure the provision of essential services, support any department of state, including support for purposes of social economic upliftment, and effect national border control. The problem is that the impression created is like the call up of the reserves will only be for the purposes of executing these obligations. Whereas the intention is to actually make the reserve force to be available as and when the Chief of the Defense Force finds a need for additional troops to carry out the constitutional obligations of the Defense Force. Because, you see, if we only say the reserves are called up for these enumerated purposes here only, peacekeeping will be out of them. You can't prepare them for peacekeeping. And it is not our intention. Our intention is to say, on the basis of the one force concept that we are following, to say you have the regular force as your core, I mean, as your core force that you would want to expand when the need arises by deploying your reserves. So So the reserve must be available for all the other duties that the regular corpus is intended to, I mean, is used on. I just thought that we should point that out so that the members should not later on say, but you said the reserve, this bill is intended to call them for these purposes only. Because in the bill, when now you look at the amendments of Section 53 of the Act that are proposed, the insertions there do not bring about the constraints that this memorandum is suggesting. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. I think I'm partly covered, sir. I was going to try and explain the difference of, in terms of the responsibilities between the minister and the commander. The minister actually has the power to do this contract and call up. But the commander will deploy the forces that are there. The minister does that on behalf of, as a cabinet member who looks after the defense force. So she gives the appropriate member or authority to actually get into this contract. And then the defense force chief will deploy the forces that are there. If she decides to delegate that, it's something else. But actually that is the minister's responsibility.
Are the state advisors going to respond to the questions from Mr. Mlangeni and the name?
That's right. The democratic process.
Thank you, Chairperson. Bear in mind, honourable member, that this amendment seeks to compel members of the reserve force to report for duty when called up only. But it compels them to report for duty under the circumstances mentioned in the amendment. During peacetime, they won't be compelled. But I did indicate in response to an earlier question that the details of the call-up and the details of the contract will be prescribed by regulation, and that would have to be worked out between the minister and the interested parties. You will notice that we don't take away the right of the members of the reserve force to extend their voluntary service in consultation with the minister and the defense force on such terms and conditions as may be agreed upon. And I suppose I'm not in a position to answer the third question, or for that matter the second question, but I suppose the military could use some of those members beyond the 30-day call-up in any way the military decides to use them, and that would entail, I suppose, an ad hoc sort of absorption into the military, but that's for the military to decide. And so, yes, it does appear to be a little contradictory, and we can improve the language if needs be, but members will not be compelled except under the circumstances of the Act or those prescribed in the regulations. Thank you.
Then close and move on. Yes, I wanted to indicate to Comrade Mlangeni that what he is reading is the situation as it is, and that is what we're seeking to address, the particular question you asked. And then David Mania wanted to know on the memorandum 4B, actually this was my memorandum. How it got to your hands, I have no idea. What our lawyers were trying to do was to explain to me under what circumstances in the past we've been able to do that. If, for instance, and this is one example that they used, if, for instance, you have a people whose responsibility is to look after the security of a base, and three of them go AWOL because they did not have permission, then you need to have somebody quickly to call up to put them in that particular position. So it was just the nearest example that that was used. That is not the only reason why we use up reserves, but it was meant to be for ministers' eyes only. Okay, but we did use them when some of our soldiers went without permission to ensure that we can have complete cover at all times in our bases. Yeah.
Can we go to the next one?
The next one, Chairperson, Minister, Deputy Minister, and Honourable Members, will be dealt with by Herman Smuts, and that relates to the establishment of the Commission. I do want to point out, though, that the actual content of that section dealing with the Commission is still the subject of discussions between myself and my team and the Minister and her advisers. Initially, we had a fairly detailed section regarding that. The Minister is keen to establish that commission as soon as possible, and we've asked the Minister to rather pause a little bit and to allow us to properly consider what will be the final content of the draft. And this morning, the Minister instructed us to have that ready well before the 29th of May, which is the date by which he hopes to formally deal with this. So I do need to point out to you, Chairperson and Honourable Members, that the work that what you're going to be dealing with now is still work in progress, and we are waiting for final instructions from the Minister. But what the bill does purport to do, and I'll ask Advocate Smuts to deal with that, is to establish your commission, your military service commission, to deal with various things relating to the military. But how it's going to be populated, we still want to receive instructions on those, and that will happen after our engagement with the Minister and the team. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, the intention of the bill is also to formalize the current situation. In other words, to formally make provision for the establishment of a permanent Defence Force Service Commission. And of course, the commission would have functions, for instance, to make recommendations to the Minister regarding improvements on salaries, service benefits, on conditions of service, etc. As Enver said, the provision in the bill will still be populated in accordance with the instructions of the Minister and as Cabinet approved. But we will have a document ready well in advance of the required date. I think that's all I can say at this stage. I don't know whether my chief would like to add to that.
There's limited information in relation to this one. I think let's proceed and wait until there's full information. Yeah. But it's a very crucial part of the amendment. You must understand it, because that's where the happiness of the soldiers lies. So we would really want you to work on it a little bit faster so that it could help us to process it. But the detail of how we process, we'll discuss it with the Minister. But we'll be expecting it to be finalized. I don't think anybody wants to raise questions about it. Let's proceed and get another piece of legislation.
Those are the only two that they had come prepared to submit to us. The other piece of legislation which we will be putting before you is the policy on military veterans, military veterans department. I don't know if the bill is ready yet, or perhaps we'll have another time.
Okay. As the Deputy Minister did outline, as I had reported in the last past meeting, that he had set out some processes out of consultation to try to finalize the military veterans policy arrangement, so that when it comes in front of us, it comes in as a full document. So we'll await for that one as one of the documents that we would want to finalize. Or he promised that he was making sure it goes to cabinet, and from cabinet it will come here from us. I know everybody's eager to have it. Can I have you, sir?
Thank you, Chairperson. With regard to the report from the task team on military veterans, I think on the 18th of January or the 19th of January, there was supposed to be a report from the task team from the Honorable Makwetla to the minister. Whether that event take place, whether the report was given to the minister, and if so, when can we have sort of information or insight into that report? Thank you. That's above the legislation. Thank you.
Yes, there's one aspect of this process that intrigues me. A ministerial task team was set up, presumably, to make recommendations to the minister. It was set up under the deputy minister. It has been deliberating for several months, and we understand that a report has been submitted to the minister. But on the 15th of December, there was a proclamation providing for a new department. So it seems to me that the decision to set up a new department was taken prior to the committee making its recommendations to the minister. And we know from our briefing on the military veterans last year that the question of the structure, the optimal structure for the military veterans department, was going to be a key part of the committee's deliberations. So it seems to me that a decision has been taken about the structure of the department without the committee. Is that correct?
Then, that's my question. Then, yeah.
I don't know whether I'm looking at the correct document. I mean the terms of reference of the and the testing, not testing the commission. Yeah. You say that where you write, please note that the first portion of it. You say the president is the commander in chief. Has, with the support of cabinet, declared that deunionization of the SANDF must be accomplished as soon as possible. How far are we with that, Honorable Minister?
Chairperson, with your permission, could we deal with those matters, isolate those matters that have to do with the latest that law state law advisors, and then release them, because some of the matters now that are being dealt with are part of our own program. But yes, we will come back to that, which is a question by the honourable three honourable members in relation to which the deputy minister will answer, and then the one by honourable Langeni, which I will answer. But before I ask that we release the state law advisors. We had a meeting 2 weeks ago with the portfolio committee, and I was indicating to them the kind of lacuna that we have that I might want them to have a look at. And because the matter has now passed cabinet, they still have the opportunity to make necessary amendments, because finally when the bill is with them, they can chuck it down the dustbin or vamp it up. So my request to them was to look at this particular lacuna, which I thought I should mention to you because you will be assisting them. In the Constitution, the appointment of the military command is the responsibility of the commander-in-chief, which is the president. In the law, the president may only, in the Defense Act, the president appoints the chief of the defense force. And this has become a serious problem for us around which, how do we define the military command? Because outside of that, what is now left to us is to follow the public service administration route of appointing the chiefs of the services. And this is a completely different administration altogether. As I was pointing out to the committee, should you want to appoint a chief of a, who is, in terms of the perception of the public service, chief of the service is a level of a DDG. You have to advertise, you have to put up a committee to do the interviews, and then you have to table it before the cabinet. Now, our structure is not like that. It is almost like an academic institution. You graduate towards a particular situation, which has nothing to do with the outside world, nothing to do with advertisement. But we're not catered for in the Public Service and Administration Act. We are not catered for in that way in our own law. So there was a blind spot around that particular area, which I would have wanted them to have a look at, so that as they amend the law, they are either able to give a procedure around which these people may be appointed, or we define what military command indicates. My view at the time that we were discussing was that we should find a process by which the president indeed does appoint, in terms of the law, or in terms of the constitution, does appoint the military command. David Mania here was saying that it would seem that we are creating a bit of a disorder in the defense force if everybody is appointed by the president. So amongst ourselves, we did think maybe what we could do is propose that the chief of the defense force, no, I think what he was saying is that the chief of the defense force ought to appoint the chiefs of the services. And I'll say, no, that is not the way that it would work, because that is a chief of a service in his own right that reports to the chief of the defense force. So we tried to work out ways in which this could be done, in which we can streamline that, if you could be thinking through. But I could have fallen off my chair when I read the media the next day, giving the impression that the minister wants to appoint the chief of the services. I didn't. I actually don't. And I think it is, I thought it was important that the president should, we should find a way in which there is a difference, a distinction between the chief of the defense force and the other services. But in the same way that we do with intelligence, that the president appoints both the head of the intelligence services and the chiefs of the services of intelligence. And I thought that was, there was a precedent, and check if it works and go that way. Because you see, these are people who have command of huge arsenal, and therefore there must be a weight attached to their appointment because of the responsibility. But if by discussion with the committee we feel that it should be the minister and then the president, easy, as long as there's a process, so that we are able to adhere to that process, because right now we have a serious problem in the appointments in the defense force. Thank you.
We will then release the state law advisor. We still come back to Parliament when you are ready. And thanks for coming to us, and thanks for your advice.
Did I say 29th May or did I say 29th April? No. 29th May is the day on which the Portfolio Committee would have wanted to put it through Parliament. Thank you.
And then the old mayor called choir. And on the page of the Portfolio Committee.
You can have some of the juice there.
Thank you.
we'll leave that deputy minister to come in now.
Chairperson, thank you, and committee members. I'm coming in to respond to point 2 on the agenda, progress made in establishing the Department of Defense and Military Veterans. Just to say, Chairperson, through you, that the task team that the Minister established last year completed its work in November, and in December, and to be exact, on the 28th of December, the department was proclaimed. It was a proclamation to establish the new department, and the report of the task team was formally presented to the minister on the 26th of January. Now let me just go back and say that to committee members who were present when we reported on the work of the task team last year and indicated the process that we're going to undertake, that they will recall that we did indicate that the task team's terms of reference were two things. First was to come up with policy recommendations with respect to benefits and support services that military veterans must get from government, and the definition of beneficiaries, who these beneficiaries are, and then secondly to come up with an organizational structure through which these deliverables will then be rolled out by governments to beneficiaries. We indicated at that meeting and also at the workshop of stakeholders that we held last year that there was already consensus with respect to the second responsibility of the task team, proposing an organizational structure to roll out these benefits. There was already agreement that there should be we should actually have a department established within the Ministry of Defense and Military Veterans. So that was no longer a matter in principle to be dealt with by the task team. And at that point, the minister wisely advised that the process of establishing the department must therefore start running concurrently with the work of the task team to generate recommendations on policy. So in December, the proclamation, the process of establishing the department proceeded with the proclamation that Mr. Menir referred to. And as I say, the report of the task team will be with cabinet, the next cabinet sitting. The DG was going to check on the 29th of April, those recommendations, the minister will be tabling them before cabinet, and in discussion in cabinet, the minister will finalize that report and will bring it back to the portfolio committee. Thank you, Chair.
Another short report about what goes on in the military veteran. I don't think it does open up a discussion. Mm-hmm.
The question that was asked by David about the proclamation having been done before the portfolio committee had a look at it, at the matters. The proclamation of departments is the responsibility of the Department of Public Service and Administration, and therefore they will run processes. We must have been one of about 8 other departments that were established, and that had to be done. So whether we were lagging behind was really none of their business. It had to be done at a particular time. Also, there were deadlines that had to be met, because by this year, which is the beginning of April, there had to be money allocated to this department. So there could not have been money allocated in our budget to a department that is none that does not exist. So those time frames are set outside of ourselves.
I raise the issue because the question arises, the train has now left the station, whether indeed this was, in retrospect, consistent with best practice, and whether it would be consistent with least cost, and whether it would be the optimal model. And I think that Parliament ought to have played a role in looking and analysing what kind of structure would be optimal. That's my point. But it seems the train has left the station.
No, the train was not going to arrive at your station with respect to this matter. Actually, just yesterday, we had a workshop to fine-tune the proposed structure of the department. That the department was protected shouldn't imply that the exact size and design of the structure was adopted in December. No, that is what we were actually yesterday in a workshop working to finalize, to sign off. Of course, it will be going to the DPSA, as the minister says, because the competency lies with them. If members of parliament have the skill to help deal with the matters of that nature, which are highly technical and administrative, that even myself I cannot intelligently speak about it would be good. I mean, we wouldn't, stop you making, contributions with respect to what kind of structure. But even in the department, we refer this matter to the organizational work study to work out, the appropriateness of structures. It's not a matter that would have brought to the committee for the committee to decide on the structure, Chairperson. Thanks.
The minister just want to go out for 2 minutes. You'll come back. Okay, that's fine. No, that's fine. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. I've noted the time frame with regard to the 29th of April, the report going to the cabinet, and then also. What you have said about the workshop that you had yesterday on, the structure. But we are debating...
I'm sorry, let me just correct that. The DG says the 29th is actually the cabinet committee, not the cabinet.
Okay.
It will be at cabinet, the following cabinet after that cabinet committee. I'm sorry, just to make that correction.
Now, we are debating the budget vote on the 4th of May. And in the absence of having information and having seen in the estimates, the budget estimates, an allocation of 20 million rand to this department, I find it very difficult to prepare my speech and to make a constructive input to reason for or against the establishment of this department. So what are you saying, Honourable Deputy Minister, to us, so that we can prepare fully as members of this committee to vote for or against that allocation?
Can I have
number three? Thank you, Chair. Maybe let the Honourable Deputy Minister answer this one first, because mine is left. I need a clarity from Honourable Minister. I was talking about the class, the structure, and I couldn't follow it. So I don't want to destroy this question because I still need to be clarified.
Do you want me to repeat my question? My question was really, it would be incumbent on us to come up with the optimal structure. But my point is, it seems that a decision has already been made that there will be a separate department. And so alternative structures, or deliberating or considering alternative structures, is really not relevant. And for that reason, I said that the train has left the parliamentary station. Thanks.
Okay, fine. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. But you know, there is not the problem. The situation in South Africa that we were faced with is to not create time to take ourselves, all of ourselves together. And when we talk about structures, we're not talking about structures as the whole world would be talking about structures. We're talking about structures influenced by the historical background. I was listening from SABC 2 this morning. I won't say who this person is because it's known. You know, people end up listening to passengers in the aeroplane. This guy was saying, I was shocked to hear this person coming from abroad saying our charges for medical treatment in South Africa, I pay quarter of what I was going to be paying in America. And I'm really excited that South Africa has taken such a short time to do this operation for me. It's a guy who is so exposed to things. He's running a radio station, a SABC station, but it needs him to be told by a passenger who came to South Africa to actually be operated, for him to realize that South Africa is emgangathweni. If you were to tell that gentleman, SABC News today, we're not going to listen from you. It takes him so much years to listen from foreigners who came to be operated in South Africa, and they are phrasing it. And if we keep on dodging this opportunity of saying, why are we doing this and that, unlike the world class, whatever, we will always be in a problematic situation. I'm saying this because for a good reason. The deputy minister here, the minister is here, we are all here. That whatever we do, yes, I know we're rushing for the budget vote, we're rushing for the soccer, whatever. But men, we are leaving behind something that will not allow us to understand together. Whether in the world there was once a section called military veteran, or it was never there, we've got the reason why. Thank you, Chair.
I thought that you have made a mark. David, you are the last one.
Chair, I've now raised the question of structure, but just on to policy and strategic plan. Obviously, military veterans are very important. Can we expect a white paper on military veterans, and when can we expect a strategic business plan from the Department of Military Veterans?
The urgency, Deputy Minister, when I was listening to the budget vote yesterday of...
Chairperson, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I think we're now running a risk of losing the extent of our discussion. There are several questions raised, and not necessarily speaking to one point. And I thought that we should just make sure that everything that is raised is clarified. Otherwise, at the end, we'll not be sure what it is that we're talking about. Earlier on, there was a point that was raised by the...
Sorry. Earlier on, there was a point that was raised by the... let's say the Honorable Member Smile. I don't know whether we deal with that one first, or we go back to Manir's question about structure. And deal with it and play it and go back to that question. I just need your guidance.
Okay, I'll take guidance.
Okay.
No, I was taking Mr. Smiles, and then Manir came in. I wanted to close the question, that's why I was giving everybody an opportunity and allow Commissioner to make a comment so that we round up. That's what we are trying to do. But you must go to Mr. Smiles, and then we'll come back. That's one other thing, Manir. Yes.
Mr. Smiles' question, Chairperson.
Mr. Smiles' question, Chairperson, was in the absence of the report now to the committee, how are they expected as members to speak intelligently, about the matters around military veterans at the budget debate, and that the 20 million allocated, they do not have the information about whether this is adequate or not. Let me just say, Chairperson, with respect to that, that in this budget that we're going to be debating on the 4th, the item military veterans is allocated only 20 million, as members are aware. And that allocation was an allocation not based on the work that this department is going to do. It is a budget that was an estimate of what reasonably we may require immediately in order to get the department off the ground. It is money that will be used for the immediate people to be employed in the structure, money that will be utilized for infrastructure issues like computers and so on, and if there's accommodation that has to pay the rental to be paid, it will be intended to address that. But the Department of Military Veterans is about providing benefits and services to military veterans. They are not going to come out of that 20 million. That 20 million is nothing compared to what the department is going to be about. So that is something that will be dealt with only after the policy recommendations have been finalized by Cabinet. Cabinet has agreed what benefits, what services, and the population of beneficiaries also has been ascertained, because that is another process that must still be run. That budget will come after. I just wanted to, you know, provide that clarification. Unfortunately, of course, we are in that situation where we cannot present that report. The minister cannot present that report to the portfolio committee before he finalizes it in cabinet, because when it comes to the to the cabinet, I mean to the portfolio committee, it will come as policy recommended by government, and that's what the members will be engaging with. Yes, the issue about structure that David is raising, I'm understanding him differently now, that he's not saying the committee would have wanted the presentation on the structure so that it can comment on the structure, whether the department size is the right size, the way it is designed, it will be able to tackle the functions that policy says must be executed by this department. But he's saying the very principle of having a department itself is what should have been brought to the committee. And the minister has explained why.
Thank you. No, it will be no dialogue, Chair. Thank you. Chairperson, thank you very much. There's only one concern that I have when the Honorable Deputy Minister says that 20 million is nothing. It is something, because it is 20 million of the taxpayers' money. So, and we are at a disadvantage in the absence of having sort of a plan or something in front of us about that 20 million. Even that is not coming to us. So there is a big concern, even relating to the report, that we don't have information. So that, to me, is not acceptable.
Okay.
I have
I want to respond to what the Honorable Member said, and that the Chair was...
Okay, you see, I don't want to open up a dialogue. I wanted to take the last question so that we can move forward.
David,
but those remarks are very unfortunate. I didn't say this is nothing. I've said this money is intended for this. I've indicated what is it going to be used for. I didn't say it's nothing. It is not a budget for what the department is doing. Yes, in respect to what the department is going to be doing, this is not that it's nothing. It's not for that. But I've said what that money is intended for. And the point that he's making that we should provide information about what is it that we're going to be able to do from the 20 million, I think it's a fair comment. Thanks.
No, I see, I was going to answer to this question, this issue here, with our colleague here, that we have been told that the 20 million is merely to establish an office, a department. And once that department has been established, it will now start working on how to solve the problem of the veterans. The staff has got to work from somewhere. They can't work from their vacuum. And I understood that the 20 million was merely to establish an office or a department, if you like.
As long as you understand that the member has to raise this question to satisfy me. Okay.
Chair, thank you. I'd like to bring to your attention that, in fact, the report of the ministerial task team is right there. Perhaps I could reach over. Chair, just to the Deputy Minister, I did ask whether it is his intention in terms of process to table a green paper on military veterans and a strategic plan during the course of this financial year.
Chairperson, of course, this is a matter to be determined by the minister. But just to say, the strategic plan and the white paper don't necessarily, belong together. Mm-hmm. In the sense that a white paper, it's still a matter the minister may decide on later, because what we have, this report, it's recommendations on policy. On policy matters. But remember, members, that the reason why we went the route of a task team to come up with recommendations is because we are avoiding coming up with the whole process of starting with a white paper, green paper, white paper, and having a public discourse in the country around what military veterans should get from government because of the urgency of the matter. However, the minister later on may still, want to engage the public, and the task team report does indicate that the minister may still want to have that kind of comprehensive policy, to be discussed by the country around military veterans. But the minister will make that judgment call. With respect to the plans and the budget, there will be plans and budget for this for the financial year 2011-2012. The process starts now. It's not going to wait for a white paper. Should the minister decide that later on, she would want to ask to have a white paper. Thanks.
We will clarify that we are going now to Operation Corona. That is 3.4. 3.3, we said we are standing over. I'll leave. Okay.
Chairperson, on the issue of 3.3, at the last meeting we had agreed that perhaps what we would do is arrange for a meeting with people who are more conversant with the law, so that by the time we take any decision, because I had been informed that the decision finally lies with Parliament, so that by the time we take a decision, it is a decision that is informed by a consensus of legal opinion, and we are able to move forward swiftly. What I did want to say is we are already sitting with a particular situation. In terms of the reserves, the reserves are by law excluded from being or forming any union. So even as we incorporate them into the Defence Force, those are people that fall outside of any of the matters that we're dealing with. So the sooner we do come to some kind of early decision on this matter, the better it will be for everybody, so that we're not dealing with a force of unequal regulations or concerns. So that one will stand down. May I therefore, with your permission, Chairperson, go on to the matter of 3.4. 3.4 is the Operation Corona. Operation Corona is the operation that takes us back to the borders. We are already in the borders and in the process of handing over bit by bit from the Defence Force to ourselves. And as I indicated, an unfortunate situation has already arisen where the farmers, because of the phased-in approach, the farmers in the Free State are very concerned about us. We are arranging a meeting with themselves so that we can assure them that we are very concerned about their security. I'd like to take the opportunity, should any of you be available on that particular day, and to accompany me. This is a constituency that needs to be assured that their safety is important to us. We're not just personing the borders to ensure that there is no cross-border crime around issues of drug smuggling and cars. For farmers, their stock is very important to them. That is their investment. They should not feel that at any stage we are devaluing what they own or their concerns. So we're arranging that meeting so that I can sit down with them and we go through what our arrangements are. So right now I will hand over to the Admiral. Specifically, what we're doing now is the arrangements around what we will be doing with yourselves. We've invited you to the borders so that you see what the state of the borders is, how long it's going to take us to have maximum security around the borders, what percentage we are taking with us, and to take us through also the arrangements. Chairperson, I don't know if you were informed, we had to turn round a warship on Thursday. Was it on Thursday? That's not normally, that's not done anyway in the world. But that taught us that perhaps what we need to do in meetings like this is to be quite certain that all of us are understanding what it is that we are embarking on. Because the operation out at sea was so timed that the attack should be at a specific, it was an exercise. And the reason why I invited you, perhaps this for members who are new, this would not have been explained. Civilians are not allowed onto war zones or warships or to areas like this. They can only go there accompanying the minister. So I thought, you know, we've heard about frigates. We've heard about all of these things. Let me ask the media and yourselves to accompany me. So under the guise of accompanying the minister, we got onto the frigate. But it was an exercise. And unfortunately, it had to be short-circuited because of some reason or other. And one of our members here lost a shoe. I have asked Charlotte, who is head of my protocol, to please ensure that by the end of this session, she has a brand new set of shoes. The shoes fell into the sea. So, yes. Yes. So this time what we're going to do is to be quite certain so nobody loses their hat or any attachment, or in your case your false teeth, Jefferson. And to the member who lost her shoe, our sincerest apologies. We would like to make up for that. We really had thought that all the necessary arrangements between your secretariat and our secretariat had been made. And in future, Chairperson, please let us not turn around the warship. It's not done. It just is not done. Thank you very much. Over to the Admiral.
Yeah. Just before the Admiral comes in, in relation to the deployment of our troops on the borders, where we're going to see what is happening, Are these two countries aware, that is Zimbabwe and Mozambique, are they aware of the deployment of our troops there? Are they aware of the reasons why we are deploying them, and that we are not at war with them, but perhaps at war with the people who are their own citizens who are crossing into our country illegally? It's an unfortunate thing to say, that we are at war with our citizens, but not the government. What is the position, Minister?
Before we took this decision, Honorable Mlangeni, I undertook a visit to Mozambique to explain, amongst other things, to explain to them that we are returning to the borders. They were only too happy, because what it means is that we have a dual responsibility, and it lessens the load on them. They are not a country that has as strong an economy as ours, so they therefore feel they can lean on us. But we have informed them. We also took the opportunity to visit Zimbabwe when we had a joint commission on security to inform them that we are taking up our responsibilities around the border. They were equally excited. When you go to these places, they will be there to meet with yourselves. We have arranged that they should be there. So they will be explaining to you what they've been doing in our absence. They will be, I think we have joint operations and joint meetings too around the border. So they will be explaining to you what their view is about our return to the borders. And they do know that we are not going to the borders because we are at war with them. We are going to the borders to relieve the strain on their shoulders because they've had to do this in our absence. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, Minister, Deputy Minister, Honourable Members. Possibly by way of introduction, just... I've gone off again.
You have corrected Peter Steve.
Minister, specifically in the briefing we gave to Portfolio Committee that day, we made a statement that Petrosif was a farm in that area where we have a training base for military currently.
Okay.
And we
speak to the media. Please speak to the media. We're not talking about the town. You're talking about a place where we keep our people. Is the media with us? So we will not be on Hogarth any longer around the city we're talking about. It. Thank you very much.
Honourable Members, on a lighter note, one of my staff actually sent an email response to Hogarth in which he gave them the geographic position of it and invited him to come and do some geography lessons. But nevertheless, Honourable Chair, Members, just to say that South Africa has land borders of roughly 2,400 kilometres. Obviously, during your visit, you will only see a fraction of those borders. And also, we would like to show you why the Berlin Wall approach will not really work. If you have 2,400 kilometers, the force levels needed are quite excessive, and therefore why we're going to follow a very mobile type of deployment.
Just make sure that you're speaking to the mic. Remember, we don't hear properly.
This is not B2C.
Specifically, with regards to the visit, if I may start with that, Chairperson, I believe my office has been in communication with your office and have furnished you with the draft program and has also acceded to a request from you that we in fact meet you in Cape Town. That is the last information I had. If I may then speak specifically to the program at the 28th through to the 30th. The first day will be taken flying from Waterkloof. It will be an early start in the morning as per the program you received, flying up to Messina. And may I indicate that as far as the flying in the region is concerned, we're going to do all the flying in the Oryx helicopters for two reasons. One, the fixed-wing aircraft that we do have, the larger ones, the runways up in the far north are not of a state that we would like to land on some of those with you, so therefore helicopters, and also some of the places we want to take you are only accessible by helicopters. So from Waterkloof to Messina, it's a long leg, about 2 hours, and we'll land there, and there you will ride in relatively comfortable vehicles. We will hire luxury vehicles, bus and car for that area, because the terrain is fairly good there, and we will take you specifically to look at the condition of the road that the Department of Defense built there along the border, and also the condition of the fence, and you can also meet troops that are already on the ground in that area. That first day you will then, at the end of the day, ship to Komatipoort. We will provide lunches, obviously, during the course of that day, and maybe if I may just put myself, or interrupt myself, is to say, you're actually going on patrol, so it will not be five-star hotels in that region. Please do consider that, and we will provide the best that that area can offer. And also, please do wear comfortable clothing, if I may use that. You can't lose shoes, if I may say that, on the land like at sea, but it's easier to walk with flat shoes. There's sand, there's stones, etc., so for your own comfort, if you can wear comfortable clothing. The area can get very hot in the day and very cold at night, so again, I would like to just point that out. When you go to Komatipoort, we'll accommodate you there for the evening, and then the next morning, the intention is to take you from Komatipoort along the actual border fence between South Africa and Mozambique. The actual distance that we will drive on the border will depend on how early we can start and if there's any delays in the program. But we think about 30 kilometers that you can drive along the fence. You can actually see how close to the South African border the villages are on the other side. You can see the traditional crossings. That border has been open, when I say semi-legally, for many, many years. There are children who live on the one side. They actually come through gates that are in the fence. They go to school in the afternoon. They go home again. But to show you that the communities are very much interactive in that area. But then we'll also indicate to you the areas where we have the vehicle crossing and the likes. You will see that the area is fairly inhospitable. Water is a major challenge for forces along that area. It's got to be taken in. The idea then at the end of the evening is that you will then depart from the vehicle. Now, may I say that that part of the trip as the next day, members, we will be putting you in 4x4 Land Rovers. That's the type of vehicle, so I trust you'll be comfortable with that. If there are any members who so desire and would like to actually ride on the back of an open troop rack to experience what the soldier will be doing his patrol in, that is also available. So to get a real feeling. That afternoon when you mount up in the aircraft, and that's now the 29th, we wish to fly you on a section of the northern Swaziland border so that you can again see the mountainous terrain, the difficulty of access to that area, and with your permission, we would like to open the doors that you really get the feeling of flying like people on patrol would fly. So a warm jacket would be good then. But that would be up to you members, and obviously the aircraft crew. The evening we'll stop in Pongola, and then very early the next morning do a short hop to Ndumu. Both in Pongola and Ndumu you can see operational bases, the condition that they are in, what work has to be done. There's a current challenge that we have, chairperson members, in that we've worked for the last 3 days with police. They say that they've received no instruction on withdrawal, and they're actually increasing their presence in some of the bases. So the occupation of the bases that we previously had is becoming an issue, but we will take that through the departmental channel. But from that base, we wish to fly you very short distance into one of the nature reserves which bounds in the southern Mozambican border. And then again put you in vehicles for about 15 to 20 kilometers from it's a corridor between Mozambique and the Ndumbu and the Tembe game reserves, which is also a very large crossing point for illegal stuff. There's a very large community along that border already, and there's a thriving trade between southern Mozambique, northern KwaZulu-Natal in that region. The taxis run both sides, pick up people, and they move across fairly freely. There's clinics there. You'll see 300-400 Mozambican citizens sitting in the clinics. which obviously takes resources. So how do you deal with that if the soldiers go back? Do you stop a practice that has been running for many, many years? And then basically stop at Tarazella on the Mozambique South African border post, and from there fly to back to Pretoria, to Waterkloof, and then the next morning that you're free to depart, or if any members would like to depart that evening. We would like to, a chairperson also recommends the minister to hold the function either the second last night. We originally thought in Pongola, but the facilities there are not that good, so possibly the last night in Pretoria. And that's detail that's still being discussed between the Head of Communication Office, Ministry, and your office. So that essentially is the trip and the detail of the trip. May I ask members to take anti-malaria prophylactics before the time? It's always preferable to take it at least 2-3 days before the time, depending on what prophylactic you do. There will be full medical support during the whole trip, and we will have each area medical personnel if there's any medical problems en route. Possibly, Chair, if I stop there with the visit side, if there's any questions to the visit, and then if there's questions to the actual rollout, we can carry on with that.
Is there anything that members want to talk about? Dr. Tom?
Thanks so much, Comrade Chairperson. Comrade Chairperson, it's not a question, but just a short comment. Thanks for Minister and Deputy Minister to organize this important trip, because according to me it's very important, because it's empowering us. Sometimes when you are talking here in Parliament, you're just talking, you don't even know the problem our members face in outside. Now I think Minister is very, very, very important. As a new member of this committee, and I was a member for Correctional Services since 1994, and I know very well about correctional services, but since last year, be on this committee, did not go outside. Mm-hmm. But now, to organize this trip is very, very important, empowering us. When we are here, also our member can see the Parliament support them. I think that is very, very important on this matter. Thanks very much.
Any comment? Azir?
I see that on the program here we are arriving at O.R. Tambo at 3 o'clock. Now, on many occasions when there are trips and we are meeting at the airport, we end up not knowing the exact spot.
You have a very strong voice.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
No. Yeah, I have a rally voice. Now, if I raise it up, I'm going to. Okay. Yeah. All I'm saying is that, can we have the exact point of assembly for us at the airport, so that we don't run around at the airport not knowing where to find who? And secondly, to point out that some of us that stays in the province, is it necessary that we come at 3 or come at 4? Because I see we'll be departing at 5.
I think all those details have been sorted out. Nabal Mazi, he's taken note of those that stay in Gauteng, that they might be. Details will be taken of you, and people will be sent to both people up and take you to the guest house itself, more than going to the airport. So all the details are being sorted out. People are being referred to. People will be coming from outside Gauteng that will be given some transport also. But mainly, and the office of the ministry are really sorting out all that particular detail. Everything is going according to plan. I think let's move. No, it's fine. That every you've got a program in front of you today.
Yeah, tomorrow,
you'll be knowing that. She'll keep you on the cell phone. She'll inform you that. She's been doing that very well. Okay. Minister, let's go to the next point. Thank you.
thank you. Chairperson, we are now...
I'm sorry to... Do I understand correctly that we are now moving off Operation Corona onto another agenda item? If that's the case, I misunderstood what was happening. I do have a question in respect of Operation Corona. Could I put that question?
Is that related to the operation? as Operation Corona?
Yes. Okay. I'll make it quick. I mean, the Minister is absolutely right. A briefing was provided to Parliament about Operation Corona, the deployment to the borders, and it was done on the basis that it was a proposal. It was not the final plan, and my question, therefore, in the light of the fact that the proposal does not make provision for the employment of forces on the Free State Lesotho border, has the proposal being revised, and is it your intention to provide for an employment of soldiers on the South Africa-Lesotho border in this financial year? And I raise that question because I understand that in fact the court case between the South African government and the Free State Agricultural Union was in fact set to proceed today. Now, whether that happened or not, I don't know. But as you correctly say, this is a very important matter. You are aware of the import of the matter. But the real short question is, are we going to deploy troops on the Free State, the Lesotho border, in this financial year?
I'm not a lawyer by profession, and we've allowed our state law advisors to leave. But I think that it would be improper for us to be discussing here a matter that is serving before the courts, where the courts are required to exercise their mind on the matter. We will be engaging with the farmers so that whatever the outcome of the court case, we are able to indicate to them what our intention is. It would not be correct for me to go over the same mistake we made of making public announcements such as we did, because we wanted to make sure that members of parliament are along with us, and therefore causing insecurity in some sectors of our society. I wasn't here at that time, but what we were explaining to you was what was approved by Parliament, by Cabinet. And I explained to you at a later engagement that, you see, the PSMA makes it very clear you cannot budget for matters that do not fall under your mandate. At the time at which we had budgeted, we had not budgeted for the border because it was not our mandate. So what we're doing now is negotiating that we have money that follows the mandate. And when that is done, obviously the plan would be adjusted accordingly. The phased-in approach was one where there originally were police that we were replacing. When you are on tour, you'll actually be given a detailed briefing of matters that we are dealing with. But I think it would really be wrong, both you and I, to be discussing a matter where a magistrate sits in judgment about the same matter as this one. I have sent out messages to the farmers to say their security is absolutely important to us, that I am terribly sorry that the information that got to them unfortunately not put in a particular correct context, and that when I do meet with them, I will explain to them what it is that we are doing. So if you'll allow me, Chairperson, not to answer that question until such time as we've heard from the courts what their judgment is. But by the time we go to the borders, all of those matters will have been sorted out. But do you know what would be good, David? If you were to say in Parliament when we budget for our budget vote, that we need money for the borders. There is very little I can do. I could tear my hair out. If I do not have the money in the budget, we work on priorities. And those priorities are unfortunately not worked out by myself.
The Minister will appreciate that the opposition cannot be her avatar, but I would be very happy to consider it.
No, but this is a misconception that David has, which is why I have been asking that we have a workshop. You see, David, in any country, there are certain things on which there is general agreement and consensus. The people who serve on the border don't care whether you're DA or I'm ANC or he or she. They serve a government. And this government consists of all of us. And I think at all times we must be extremely mindful of the fact that we have to represent them as those people who secure our border. So we can play politics in many other areas. Let's just remove them from essential matters like this. So I would, yes, as a member of the committee, I would, yes, want you to support this, because it has nothing to do with myself or anybody else, but we must ensure that the people who do the work and give their lives for you and me to be secure and safe and earn the salaries that we earn are actually looked after and they get the necessary budget.
I need to move on.
Okay, comment. Yeah, no, Chairperson, I just want us to note that the opposition is not playing a constructive role in the committee, because it is not their place to contribute constructively.
I don't want to open this discussion. This is an unnecessary discussion. I need to object to that last comment, really, just to make the objection without, you know, even try to substantiate. Not that I cannot substantiate, but just to object. Thank you.
No, let me accept the objection. Let's leave it, Honorable Mazia, please, and David, let's leave it. I mean, the minister and yourself, the point was made, but let's move on.
We are also going to the borders, and when we get there, we don't introduce members as belonging to parties. We introduce them as people who have oversight over us, who are looking after them. And one of the things that I would like us to do as we go out there, they get extremely encouraged that somebody cares, because they are in an extremely vulnerable, precarious condition wherever they are. So I'm glad that we are able to go. It's a pity we don't have enough money to go to the front areas where they are fighting, the DRC, Sudan, CAR. When we do finally have the necessary capability, we might take the portfolio committee. As I indicated to you the last time, the deputy president had wanted to go, and we're still looking for ways in which he can go. Most countries who have soldiers deployed actually go and visit their soldiers, just to give the necessary encouragement to those people.
I must say, Minister, our committee members are quite interested to go to those areas. In our small kitty, we might help to engage you in. Because we do have a small kitty from Parliament.
Oh,
okay. But one of the committees have got the right to travel.
Okay.
So if you allow it to, the engagement to take place between the staff members and at that later stage, I'll come back to the portfolio committee to give you there. Can I give you an opportunity to go to the next point?
The next point is a matter that, when we took over in defense, one of the first things that had become quite clear was that defense for... Admiral, you want to be excused? Thank you so much for your input. And just look after my people, because... we don't want anything else lost out in the borders. And perhaps we would like the media, if they would like to come, please to enroll so that we can ensure that we cater for you as well. We've made arrangements. Thank you. Members of Parliament will be in very good hands in the Admiral's hands. He's a good gentleman.
Oh, Tata, no man up here. If you can move up a little bit.
so that some other people can continue as getting space. Move closer. Angmazi Gutin in Sabelangano, Secretary of Defense. She's a very fine person. Okay.
When we took over as Minister and Deputy Minister of Defence, one thing had become quite clear to us, that Defence had continuously been having very bad audits. So what we did on when we made our maiden budget speech on budget vote was to commit ourselves that, to the extent that it is possible, this particular year we would not have an audit query. So we have been very careful to follow all the necessary recommendations that come from the Auditor General. We've taken the time to employ two separate audit companies, one that is permanently employed or assisting with the department, and one that is permanently assisting with the minister. And when I came to visit yourselves to deal with this matter, I was able to go back to the auditors and tell them that they had a very good student in me. They took me from scratch to understanding every single matter that matters around accounting. We keep those and they advise the minister. So we're able to take you through some of our concerns. I have with me here the acting SecDef and the SecDef designate, so that they can give additional assurity that this year, am I correct, Mpum? Am I correct, General Matanzima? There will not be a qualification. If there is, there will not be enough towels to wipe the blood from the floor. We've worked very hard because, as I indicated both to them and on my budget vote, you know, defense by its very nature and the equipment that it requires huge injection of money. And unless we are able to show that we've been able to husband and look after the money that has been given to us and account for it properly, it would make it very difficult for us to go back and indicate our needs, and our needs are really dire. So we've been working very hard, 24 hours a day. We've created another 2 hours, 26 hours a day, to pay particular attention to ensuring that we look after some of these problems. They've been enormous, some of them historical, some of them perhaps out of not having the necessary relationship with figures and the Auditor General's office. But now I'm told that between the acting SecDef and the SecDef designate, they now spend their evening hours with the Auditor General. Am I correct? I hope it is kosher. But anyway, we are trying to make sure that we are actually on top of the situation and can live up to our promise. So I'll give them space in the next 10 minutes just to give the necessary assurance. Please bear in mind we have briefed the committee on what the audit findings were of the Auditor General, and what we understood by them, and what the department was doing, what the minister would be doing, and I think we circulated that document last week. But we just did have two grey areas, and I've got my fingers crossed that you're going to assure us that there isn't going to be a single grey area when the financial reports are closed in July. Thank you.
I'm giving over to you. Acting SecDef.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I want to agree with the Minister that we have prepared almost everything, and we are trying to promote cooperation between the two departments, ourselves and the Auditor General. When we were preparing, actually, we sat with them to go point by point on our responses to whatever query, the qualifications that the Minister is referring to. We sit with them, and we are very pleased that they cooperate in actually guiding us. What has given us more hope also is the appointment of the Secretary for Defense designate. With her experience, She is bringing a wealth of experience which will enable us to improve the situation. And we have these companies, KPMG, that are helping us to also work down the qualifications. We have an action plan that has been adopted, and we are hopeful that everything will go well in this financial year, because we are responding to all the queries. And we are also engaging Treasury to make sure that when we do finalize this action plan, they are also on board. We are very committed to improving the situation. We have asked the Secretary for Defense Designate to actually lead this operation, because long term she is taking over this responsibility. We have prepared everything. I don't want to take over the whole explanation. I will hand over to Mrs. Bumi.
Honorable Chairperson, thank you very much. The Minister, the Deputy Minister, honorable members of the committee, I can gladly indicate that Operation Clean Audit is well on track. Significant progress has been made in relation to responding to the issues directly contained in the audit report of 2008-2009. And can I also confirm that we are running a parallel process which would include both the audit qualifications contained in the report of 2008-2009, but also the current audit that will be embarked upon by the Auditor General starting in this period, to be concluded on the 31st of July in the audit of financial year 9 and 10. And running both of those processes in parallel would give us an opportunity to eliminate the outstanding matters in relation to the action plan, but importantly to ensure that we're able to, as best as we can, eliminate the qualifications. They would be challenges somewhat in the historical, in the areas that have been qualified because of historical problems. We shall endeavor in that respect to ensure that we arrive together with the Auditor General at a satisfactory resolution to those matters, particularly registering significant progress on our side, with particular outstanding matters, if I may relate specifically to the issue of the information system as it relates to assets and the long-term work that can only be really concluded in the long term. We hope that with those interventions we'll be able to satisfy the Auditor General, particularly on those aspects. Can I also confirm that in the last 2 weeks we have met them at least twice to engage extensively on these particular matters, but we have sufficient, adequate direction from the Auditor General as to what needs to be done. And can I also indicate in our action plan, this week we'll be finalizing several of the matters that are required to finalize, including engagements with National Treasury around the moratorium on the system, including condonement of some of the items that relate to irregular expenditure, and we will then deal with the smaller outstanding items and deal with them appropriately. The matter that relates to housing allowance, I can also confirm, is a matter that requires condonement, and that matter is going to be finalized this week and we'll be able to deal with it. So I'm really confident that in attempting to conclude this exercise of Operation Clean Audit, dealing with it in parallel in relation to the audit report of 08-09 together with the 9-10 as it is being audited, will enable us to reach the 31st of July in a much better position than we have been. Thank you very much.
That's a small report. David? Chair, just two questions really of clarification. I don't think they should take long. It seems that a clean audit is contingent on
what you refer to as a deviation letter on page 3 of your report in respect of capital and intangible.
So the document was distributed last week. The week that we had the minister in front of us, she had the full page, 2, 3, 4 pages about audit, the clean audit, how she's approaching those things. And David is pulling from there. Just give the minister what she said, document.
Sure. And, I mean, Minister, I'm quite happy if we, if we could just clarify this in writing. There's reference on page 3 and page 4 to a letter of deviation in respect of capital and tangible assets. I'd really just like to clarify what that means and why it's necessary to get a letter of deviation. And then there's also reference on page 6 of the document to re-engineering procurement standing operating procedures. My question is, what changes are being made and why was that necessary? I'm quite happy to get a response in writing. It's not something we need to deal with yet.
Fortunately, I have my team which will be able to help me. Let's start with the tangible and intangible assets. You know, we had a serious problem, even ourselves, understanding what the issue was. And then we got to understand that, in fact, our definition of tangible and intangible assets as the Defense Department is very different from the tangible and intangible assets definition from finance. And as a result, we had fallen foul because we were not defining these matters in the way that they should have been defined. So in that letter that I've given you, which I gave you last week, I actually go to length to defining these things, because unless we are actually at one in the definition, we might not even understand what the problems are. The problem with our asset register is that it seems to us that it is going to take a long time for us to comply with what Treasury has laid down as the proper method of accounting. And this is a historical problem. Just to give you one example, which might not necessarily be the only example, you know, our intangible, immovable assets would include all of those assets that perhaps we might have inherited from the old government, which we are still trying to unearth. And in our estimate, it's going to take us some time to actually come up with a register of that nature. We don't want to continue on this in this way. We would like to explain to Treasury what our problem is so that they understand and give us a deviation while we clean up some of our problems. I think another one that was pointed out to us is the matter of our classification. Our classification is attached to the NATO classification because we do joint operations with NATO. And that is not taken on board when we're dealing with the Treasury. Treasury is very straight down the line. This is what you shall do, and this is how you will account for it. So we're wanting to point out some of those matters to them and see if we cannot find a deviation. It was pointed out to us that Public Works has got a letter which allows them certain deviation by Treasury, which means that some of the matters that are outside of their scope, if they're doing an audit of what is immovable assets, and they are able to have a clean audit. We are bogged down by some matters which we could actually ask for a deviation from and get permission. I think there was another matter that we were wanting to get a deviation request on?
Minister, if I may assist, National Treasury is in the process of establishing what they call an integrated financial management system for all of government. Now, that also requires that all departments align themselves with the new process that National Treasury is embarking upon. By definition, that would mean the Department of Defense is not able to proceed with its own single system and await the National Treasury process. Now, the requirement here is for that deviation from a moratorium that has been placed by National Treasury on the development of similar systems across departments, pointing out exactly the point that the minister points out, that the DoD would require to be able to proceed with its own system outside of that particular moratorium that is placed on the overall integrated system, and that it actually is able to comply with other international requirements with respect to that. And the discussions are currently being held with National Treasury to determine whether, in fact, that deviation from the moratorium, it's actually an exemption from the moratorium, may be granted for the Department of Defense.
I thought there were two. I'm looking. I know there are two matters on which, and I'm trying to remember from a sector what the next, what the other one is. I'm not sure if it is to do with the housing housing allowance matter. No. No.
No, it is as the Secretary of Designated said, on the immovable assets. Yes, it is on the deviation letter on immovable assets, and then also on the systems upgrade with respect to the integrated financial management system, to which we are beholden, as is all of government. Yeah.
But the final deviation we want from Treasury is that when we've cleared all our qualifications, we might get a medal. Yep. We've worked very hard for that. And on that matter as well, I had promised the committee that we would have, as soon as the President has appointed a Secretary of Defense, we would then also be appointing a CFO for Defense. I believed it served before Cabinet yesterday. We have recruited the acting DG of Housing to be the CFO of Defense. So as soon as the necessary administrative procedures have been followed, we will have him as the CFO of Defense. So all those matters that we had promised would be done have been done. It's taken longer than we thought, but it is because it is a transfer from one department to another, requires the concurrence of more than one minister, and the date that we've set ourselves is that by the 1st of May, he would have started the job. He is, am I right to say, he is a chartered accountant. He has been serving, he served as a chartered accountant and as a treasurer for the University of Fort Hare. He was then recruited by Treasury to come and work in Treasury. And when we thought that he was good enough for housing, we recruited him from Treasury to come and serve in housing. In all the time that he's been in housing, he's had very clean records. So we have behind us a very, very good track record. Our biggest problem is to ensure the country and people to whom money matters, that we are able to look after our finances. We've recruited him now from the Department of Housing, where he was acting DG, and he will be with us on the 1st of May.
Realize, Minister, that you are now demoting the Ministry for Settlement by putting this person who is so...
Not on that.
The reason why we wanted the best is because the budget on its own, the budget of defense is quite huge. We've had bad records with the Auditor General for the last 10 years. So we had to make sure that we do get somebody who understands government systems, who has a proven record, and is able to turn our fortunes around for good. And I did say in my time we will not have an audited statement. I don't want my time to be cut short simply because we have an audited statement from the Auditor General. I want to stay here with you, Comrade Mlangeni, for a long time.
Honorable friend. Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask the Department with regard to the impact of the financial misconduct section in the Department. What is the impact of that section? And can we have a sort of understanding of progress, I mean, in terms of performance? How many cases have been reported and yeah, the impact in short. Thank you.
Any other person who wants to say something? Mr. Daben, I see you smile. Oh, you're on leave. Oh, thank you. I'm wishing you well. It should not be a comment this time.
Shut up. It's so nice to be seeing you. We're a mother to everyone. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I'm concerned about this integrated financial management. I'm not saying they shouldn't do it, but I hope and request to guys to really have a tougher talk with the treasurer, because this department you are heading, it's of a unique nature, really. For us to be put under one roof in the integrated financial management, ensure that we don't find ourselves hit by this thing collapsed together. Because as the minister is saying, it's a big department and it demands so much and it carries all of us. The shortcut by integrating, but know who we are integrating and their needs. Thank you.
Can I give you this book?
Honorable Chairperson, if I may attempt to respond to the question on financial misconduct. And we can provide this information in writing in detail, which we have prepared. There are two categories that we concern ourselves about, which relate to the past, but also in relation to financial year 08-09. And there's a process that has been embarked upon to deal with the finalization of outstanding cases, the condonement in certain instances, but also the referral for recovery and legal action to be taken in the majority of cases. And we can give you the tables that indicate exactly how many cases there have been, how many have been condoned, how many have been referred for recovery, and the legal process that follows that on. And that information is here, it's available. We can make that available. I just don't want to go through the details. The second category is matters that are under investigation by the Inspector General, which specifically relate to, again, a whole series of cases. We have it. We have the information available, the types of cases of fraud, and what action has been taken with respect to each particular case. Where the case has been opened by the investigator with the military police, where cases have been handed over to the legal section for action, and we provide detailed information that indicates specific action to all the investigations under the control of the Inspector General that are currently under investigation.
Thanks for that response. She will definitely do it like that, Honorable. My office would facilitate that.
Chair, just a follow-up. It's not that I question the detail. I appreciate the detail. But I think the qualitative part, as I said, what is the impact? Can the department say, well, this section is doing a good work? Or it's not, you know, it's not there. We have the all this and what. So I need a qualitative sort of, you know.
No, my impression at this particular moment, and the fact that the Secretary, designate of the Secretary of Defense, is having the information in front of her, it then indicates that there's a lot of work that has gone into the work that they're doing, and we should be a little bit confident now that we are going to turn the corner. And the determination from the minister is one thing. She's been quite determined. I don't want to pray that I'll end up somewhere, but I want to say she has done a very good job. Minister, can I give you for the last point?
Okay.
We're going to the last point now, Ordinance.
Okay. The last point is not on the agenda, but it is a matter that I thought I should raise with yourself. For the simple reason that I have been extremely, extremely unhappy with a number of things that have been happening. And I just want to take you very briefly through the history of what has happened, because I believe one of us here has made comments which I think are uninformed or uninformed by the media. I have made available to each one of you letters which you can refer to, so that for ease of reference we are able to be at one and exercise maximum transparency. On the 3rd of December, SCOPA, you know, SCOPA has responsibility of receiving reports from the Auditor General, going through them, calling on the departments to come and explain what the qualifications are about and what is being done about those. That is in line with their responsibility as given to them by the rules of Parliament, which will be available to you in a little while it becomes, while it is circulated. So on the 3rd of December, SCOPA writes to the Acting Secretary of Defense and indicates to them that there will be a review of the 2008-2009 annual report of the Department of Defense, and it will be a public hearing. It would be on a Wednesday, the 2nd of February 2010. The Secretary of Defense informs us of this matter, and we spend the whole weekend going through. This is when I found the services of the auditors that we appointed very useful, because they took us through all the problems. This, you must understand, is the year before I became minister. So I needed to understand the context in which the problems arose so that I'm able to even understand the context in which we need to put in place the systems that need to be put in place. So we spend the whole weekend with our auditors, and they take us through all of these very complex matters. On the Monday, we sit with the Secretary of Defense. We convene a special COD meeting, Council on Defense, so that we are quite certain, because we're very concerned that our audit record should be clean. That's what we had promised ourselves. And he takes us through all the matters that had been prepared, the clean record that we were hoping to achieve. And we note, even as he's giving us the report, that the qualifications had come down from 17 to 9, am I correct, or 6? But we become quite comfortable that matters are in hand. And I say to the Secretary of Defense, you know, I really, to show my commitment to this matter, I would have wanted to come along with you. I want to emphasize, at this point, I had not been invited by SCOPA. I wanted to go just so that I can understand what the issues are and we're able to give them assurance about the fact that we are concerned and we are on top of the matter. Unfortunately, on that same Wednesday, the 3rd of February, was Cabinet. Wednesdays are closed to us. Cabinet, I am a member of the executive first and foremost, and that is where I respond to. And on that particular Wednesday was the day on which we were discussing the budget allocations, which are a very sore point with me and with yourselves because of the budget. So I then indicate to the chairperson, to the acting SecDef, please will you indicate to them, I really would have wanted to come, but I'm unable to come because I have to attend to the matter of cabinet. The Secretary of Defense conveys this message, and the rest is history, because it was covered in the media quite extensively. My dismay comes from the comments that come from members of SCOPA, we shall summon the minister. The minister absented herself, she should have been here, and all those kind of comments were out in the media. I had not been invited. I was taking myself there to give an assurance to Parliament that we are concerned about this record and that we want to do something about it. And I felt very dismayed that that was the attitude that was conveyed. Thereafter, I get a letter on the 8th of February. I have circulated it to you. It is from Honorable Mr. Godi, and he asks me kindly to appear as an observer. It's an invitation. He asks me to appear as an observer because the... Sorry, let me backtrack. Having seen what unfolded on television and being very concerned, I immediately got in touch with the portfolio committee, because this is a portfolio committee that I deal with, that we account to on a regular basis. I said, look, I'm very concerned about what happened in the hearing of SCOPA. Can I come and meet with the portfolio committee so that I can express to you that, in fact, we are on top of the situation? It was an unfortunate situation that happened on television, and you must have been very concerned. I asked the chairperson, please, to get in touch with SCOPA, to get from SCOPA those questions that we were unable to answer in SCOPA, so that at least we are able to take them on board. We had a meeting with yourselves. We went through all the qualifications. We went through all the concerns, so that you, who are responsible for defense very directly, understand what we are doing in relation to this. SCOPA had upheld the discussion together of the Secretary of Defense and said they would call him back. They then subsequently write to me and they ask me to come and be an observer when they meet with the Secretary of Defense. And they give the date as the 25th of February. And I write to them, and I say, dear Mr. Godi, thank you for your letter of the 8th of February. You'll find it there. As the executive authority of the Department of Defense and Military Veterans, I've been very keen to take part in SCOPA deliberations. I should have emphasized, at my own insistence. At my own instance, I had not been asked by anybody. I had not been pressured by anybody. I was going there on my own. I want to take part in the SCOPA deliberations on the financial statements and the reports of the Auditor General with regard to the Department of Defense. Unfortunately, I'm accompanying the President on a state visit to the United Kingdom, and all of you would have known that. And therefore, I will be in London on the 26th of February, and should this be the only available time for SCOPA, I will ensure that the Acting Minister of Defense and Military Veterans and the Deputy Minister of Defense and Military Veterans attend the meeting. Should it be possible to change the date, however, I would be delighted to attend. What I'm saying to them is we are absolutely concerned. We are making ourselves available. I myself am not available because I've been asked by the President to be with him. But if I'm not there, the Acting Minister and the Deputy Minister, extremely qualified to deal with this matter, will be there, because our presence was to oversee and understand the concerns of SCOPA. That one goes. The next letter I receive is from the chairperson, who says that it is dated the 20th of February. Thank you for your letter. We've decided to postpone the scheduled meeting, and as soon as the details become available, we will communicate with you. So I wait for them to communicate with me. They write to me on the 9th of March and say that you are quite kindly requested to appear before the committee as an accounting authority, and I've underlined that because I'm actually the executive authority of the department, in order to observe the proceedings. Now, fortunately, I am beyond being suspicious, but I began to wonder, why would the invitations be always at a time when I'm not available. You know, the program of the president is made public. The delegation of the president is made public. The 24th, the president was required to be in Uganda. That is what he had gone to do. The 23rd, I had a meeting with the Minister of Defense in Uganda, because one of the primary purposes of the discussions in Uganda was to unveil the tombs of our soldiers in Uganda. That was part of the primary reason. And to thank the Ugandan people for having offered us a base for our people to train in. Therefore, my presence there was pivotal. I had made these arrangements a long time ago. So I write, therefore, to the chairperson of SCOPA. And I say, as I've mentioned in my previous letter, I'm very keen to take part in SCOPA. But in addition to my responsibilities, I have executive responsibilities that are planned in advance by the government, where government has committed itself. The president has requested my attendance on his state visit, and protocol requires me to be there before he gets there, which is the 23rd. I would urge your officers, and the last line is very important to me, I would urge your officers to find another date, our officers, to find another date for the appearance before SCOPA, so that the necessary protocols are observed. You know, I'm a member of parliament, just like any of you. And when I'm invited to something, then I either am able to make that date or I'm not able to make it. In this particular case, having stated twice that I am very keen to attend, I would have thought that the necessary arrangements would have been done with my office. What dates are available for the minister and what dates have we got? Can you choose from these dates so that we actually have a concurrent? On both of these dates, I am not in the country. This letter, you will find, is written the 15th of March. The 15th of March, it is in front of you. You will also find attached, if it is not attached, it will be given to you, a slip at which this was faxed to the Secretary of SCOPA on the 16th of March. On the 23rd of March, it becomes quite clear. This time I'm on my way to Uganda, it becomes quite clear that perhaps the letter that was written by myself on the 15th of March might not have got to SCOPA. The head of ministerial services says, pursuant to your letter addressed to the Minister of Defense and Military Veterans, which was faxed to your office on the 18th, I think there's just a... I wish to apologize for the fact that my office omitted to confirm receipt of the letter by your office. The letter served to confirm verbal communication between the ministry and your office that took place last week. After we'd written the letter, the communication was done, the pack is in your letter. The head of my office phoned the secretary of the office of the Mr. Godi to say, unfortunately, the minister will be in Uganda. The letter served to confirm that, and it was given to them. So on the 23rd, when this becomes obvious, my office apologizes to say, if you had not received it, this is the situation, our sincerest apologies. What follows is unprecedented venom on television from members of SCOPA. And some of you were there. And I felt extremely aggrieved. By this time, I'm in Uganda. This is said outside of myself, unable to explain myself, unable to even interact. There is something unparliamentary about that. There is something unbecoming about that. I am always available. I have served before you on at least 20 occasions that we have had time to meet. But this is aired in the media. These people, this minister is arrogant. Why would I be arrogant when it was at my own insistence that I go to SCOPA? Without even the dignity of allowing me to return, to say, look, we will postpone this until the minister comes so we can tell her that we think she's arrogant. It is not allowed. A parliamentary portfolio committee is an extension of parliament. I'm as much an honorable member as the next honorable member, and it is not correct that things of this nature should be said. More was said. We will summon her, we will do all of these things, as though you're talking about a recalcitrant child somewhere there, you know, who has not adhered to her job. I work on this job as Minister of Defense, if I can, 24 hours, and I really did resent what I saw on television. I really did. I think it was unbecoming. I thought it was wrong. It goes on. These people think that they're too powerful. In what way would I think I'm too powerful? I was here with yourselves last 2 weeks ago, and I was saying to David Mania, Mania, I would like you to behave in such a way that you understand that my role and your role are complementary. I need you to assist me because I need a budget to be increased for the members of the Defense Force. Why would I be arrogant, recalcitrant, not wanting? I have no reason. I have nothing to gain from this. Over and above, this is not even dealing with a matter that deals with me directly. This is a matter of defense that I found in defense. I would have been only too keen to be there to understand what the concerns are from a different perspective. Arrogant, we think we're too powerful. This defense force is behaving in, etc., etc., etc. Now, it is one thing to be talking about me and using this blasphemous language and whatever it was, which I found completely unparliamentary and completely unacceptable. The Defense Force is not adhering, and they think they're too big for whatever. I mean, these are people who have nothing to do with Parliament. Why would it be put out there that we have this Defense Force that is a law unto itself, will not adhere to anything? Why? At what point does the Defense Force have anything to do with this? So what I do is I then ask Godi, Honorable Mr. Godi, I believe that my office has been in touch with yours, and the date of April the 20th is as has been arranged. The meeting arranged at my request, I would like, is a closed meeting between myself as executive authority and member of parliament and members of SCOPA only. It is important to clarify this because the meeting should not be confused with the review process, which is what they are involved in, or exercises over which the Department of Defense has, over which SCOPA has oversight over the Department of Defense. SCOPA is at liberty to arrange a review meeting with the Department of Defense at their convenience, or it could take place alternatively immediately after my meeting with yourselves. Mr. Godi writes back to me and says he doesn't understand what the meeting I'm asking for is about. So I write to him. The meeting I request with SCOPA will deal specifically with the numerous and negative comments made by members of SCOPA as reported in the media. See copies attached. These were made in my absence and quite clearly without giving me the opportunity to respond. I am making myself available so that we can deal with each comment and I have the opportunity to respond. I think it is only the right thing to do. It is an inalienable right. There is a typographical error there. Premising itself on the fact that I'm a member of parliament bearing the title honorable. That which would attach anything that is dishonorable or a dishonorable motive to myself should be based on factual evidence. I was therefore making myself available to SCOPA so that we can clear the air. Because the air of negativity, I did not want it to preside over the discussions that SCOPA should have with the Department of Defense. So I wanted us to meet as a closed committee so that after we've cleared the air, we've cleared each other's motives, we're then allowing the Department of Defense to come in an environment that is conducive for them to engage. And I want also at this point to refer at section chapter 3 of the Constitution. The Constitution is very adamant, and we're very adamant when we're drafting it. The principle of cooperation between various organs of government. It is absolutely important that these organs of government should cooperate with one another in mutual trust and in good faith by fostering friendly relations, assisting and supporting each other, and it goes on and it goes on. You'll find it in chapter 3 of this. But what you find out there, subpoena this minister, summon this minister, etc., as though there is some huge matter out there that this minister is personally responsible for. And you know I'm not. So, in my anger, I have then, extreme disquiet, I have then lodged a complaint with the leader of government business. I myself have been a member of parliament. I have been a chair of a portfolio committee. There are ways in which we interact with each other. When the chairperson here calls a meeting and that meeting is not convenient for you, you will say it is not convenient. He has no authority whatsoever to go out to the media and say, that David Mania, I'm going to crucify him, he didn't come to my meeting. You are invited to meetings. And when that meeting does not clashes with other responsibilities, then you send in an explanation and an apology. You're not able to attend. And in future, I would expect that the chairperson here would take all necessary steps to arrange a date on which these things are mutually are possible. So the meeting that I had asked for with SCOPA, which is detailed in your letters, was so that we clear the air, so that we do not allow any prejudice to be brought to bear on the defense, because we need to ensure that at all times we can give all the necessary support to the defense committee. And if SCOPA had a problem with me, I needed to have that cleared between me and themselves, and we put that beside and behind us. I therefore went and sought an audience with members of the, first with the chief whip and with the members of the study groups of the various portfolio committees that are represented in Parliament. After a lengthy discussion, it was felt that perhaps until this matter is resolved, the minister would absent herself from SCOPA. Do you know what I find this morning? Crucify that minister in the August. So I thought I would bring this to your attention. I have absolutely no intention to fight with Parliament. And I've made that clear to anybody. I'm a member of Parliament first and foremost. I have no reason to undermine Parliament. Why would I? Why would I undermine Parliament? What would I stand to gain? This minister is too powerful. Why? I really did object to that. I've taken a decision, therefore, that I'm going to ask the leader of government business to allow SCOPA to do its job over the defense community without my interference with it, and without that negative atmosphere that seems to have been prevailing outside of that, so that we give defense a fair chance to explain the work that they have done. They've done exceedingly good work. I'm extremely proud of the work that they've put in place. But I thought I'd bring this to your attention. It is on that basis that the chairperson of the portfolio committee explained a decision that had been taken by us as members of the ANC, that we would need to sort this matter out so that we clear the air and we clear the environment. So, Honorable David Mania, this is where we are. And I did object to those comments about my arrogance. I did object to those comments about my not paying respect to Parliament. From any point of view, you think about it, why would I want to undermine Parliament? As a member of the ruling party, why would I want to do that? Chairperson, thank you very much.
Members, we have come to the closure of the meeting. Do you want to say something?
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to.
Sorry, Chairperson, thank you very much. I would like these letters to be brought back, please, because this is a matter that the Deputy President is now dealing with. I gave it to you for ease of reference so that you're able to go along with me as I'm explaining.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to put a question to the Minister about the events of yesterday. In the letter dated 18 April 2010, and this is a letter from, I believe, the minister to Themba Godi, you say, and I quote, both the Deputy Minister of Defense and Military Veterans and I will attend.
You didn't?
Why not?
You've got two letters on the 18th. Okay. There are two. Right? Right. The first letter says, thank you for your letter. I suggest that I ask for a separate meeting as detailed in my other letter that I have written to you. I suggest we start with this matter at 9 o'clock on Tuesday. So that we would start with this letter where I'm asking for a meeting with SCOPA so that we can clear the air. And thereafter, after 9, we deal with this matter where the Deputy Minister and myself would attend, which is the review committee. This one is my request to deal with those negative comments that I think are unfair, unfounded, and unprofessional that were made by SCOPA in the media. And after that, having cleared the air, the Deputy Minister and myself had committed ourselves to attending this meeting. Early in the morning at 8:30, we had a meeting with the Chief Whip and sections of the chairpersons of study groups of the ANC, and a decision was taken that the minister should not attend. Thank you.
I saw that I gave that explanation in SCOPA. I did say that the minister wouldn't be available. I wouldn't open it up here now, David. Can we close the meeting now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. Can I thank you, minister?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.